founder the plans for the resumption of Athens-Ankara negotiations that had been stalled since 2016. The two sides were still trading barbs in the days leading up to the meetings. Last week, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said his country will attend those talks with optimism, but, quote, zero naivety. Issues that are on the agenda of the delegations are bilateral disputes, maritime boundaries, and drilling rights.
In talks with Greece, we hope that the issues will be dealt with within the framework of rights, law and equity, and the solutions are found. We hope that Greece respects our rights in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean and avoids actions that may cause misunderstandings.
The meetings were held with international optimism as well, especially from the EU. Analysts say this whole meeting was due to the bloc's pressure on both sides and voiced concerns over the delegations failing to reach an agreement.
The two sides met to agree on several points. Greece wants to discuss East Mediterranean and Turkey wants to discuss arming Aegean islands. Therefore, they will need more time to reach a common ground, and I think it's hard for both sides to reach an agreement, just like it was in the previous talks. I think the talks are being held mainly due to the EU pressure.
This is the 61st negotiations between the two, as talks were initiated in March 2002 and stopped in 2016 without reaching an agreement. Hopes seem high about the outcome of the talks, but given previous experiences, observers say the disputes between Turkey and Greece need more than this to be resolved. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the limelight.
Now that artificial intelligence, or AI, is providing an increasing number of recommendations to human decision makers, it is important to make sure that as a technology it is not biased and thus respects the value of fairness. The article we are about to present you has been written jointly by Raja Chatila, a professor emeritus of artificial intelligence and robotics and ethics at Sorbonne University in Paris, and Francesco Rossi, an IBM fellow and artificial intelligence ethics global leader. The piece is titled How to Address Artificial Intelligence Fairness. The article has been published by weforum.org website. Please stay with us for more of Raja Chatila and Francesco Rossi's article. Humans have many kinds of bias, confirmation, anchoring, and gender among them. Such biases may lead people to behave unfairly and, as such, as a society, we try to mitigate them. This is especially important when humans are in the position of taking high-stake decisions that impact others. We do so via a combination of education, conduct guidelines, and regulations. Now that artificial intelligence, or AI, is providing an increasing number of recommendations to human decision makers, it is important to make sure that, as a technology, artificial intelligence is not biased and thus respects the value of fairness. Indeed, those initiatives that aim to make artificial intelligence as beneficial as possible, related to artificial intelligence ethics, include AI fairness as one of the main topics of discussion and concrete work. Examples of these abound and range from the ethics guidelines for trustworthy artificial intelligence of the European Commission High-Level Expert Group on Artificial Intelligence to the focus of the World Economic Forum Global Future Council on Artificial Intelligence for Humanity. While artificial intelligence fairness has been a major focus for companies, governments, civil society organizations, and multi-stakeholder initiatives for several years now, we have seen a plethora of different approaches over time, Each of these has focused on either one or several aspects of artificial intelligence fairness. But it is now time to identify and suggest a more comprehensive view, one that covers all the dimensions of artificial intelligence fairness and exploits their interrelation in a bid to build the most effective framework, techniques, and policies. Here's the sticking point though. Since artificial intelligence systems are built by humans who collect the training and test data and make the development decisions, they can, either consciously or unconsciously, be injected with biases. This in turn may lead to the deployment of artificial intelligence systems that reflect and amplify such biases, resulting in decisions or recommendations that are systematically unfair to certain categories of people. There are already several technical tools that can help here. They detect and mitigate artificial intelligence bias over various data types, such as text, audio, video, images, and structured data. Indeed, existing bias in society can be embedded in artificial intelligence systems, and undesired correlations between some features, such as gender and loan acceptability, can be mitigated by detecting and avoiding them. Tools to improve the explainability of artificial intelligence models enable the identification of the reasons behind the artificial intelligence decisions, and can therefore also be useful in identifying bias in artificial intelligence data and models. However, technical aspects and solutions to artificial intelligence bias constitute just one dimension of the problem, and possibly the easiest one, of achieving artificial intelligence fairness. Achieving AI fairness is not just a technical problem, it also requires governance structures to identify, to implement, and adopt appropriate tools to detect and mitigate bias in data collection and processing on the one hand, and frameworks to define the necessary and appropriate oversight for each specific use case on the other hand. Let's also not forget that the notion of fairness itself is context-dependent and should be defined according to specific application scenarios. The correct definition can only be identified through a multi-stakeholder consultation in which those who build and deploy artificial intelligence systems discuss them with users and relevant communities to identify the relevant notion of fairness. Another dimension of artificial intelligence fairness relates to education. Since human biases are mostly unconscious, any path to achieving AI fairness necessarily starts from awareness building or educating. Artificial intelligence developers need to become aware of their biases and how they could possibly inject these biases into artificial intelligence systems during the development pipeline. But educating developers is not enough. The whole environment around them must be aware of possible biases and learn how to detect and mitigate them. A culture of fairness must be built. Within this, managers need to understand how to build diverse developers' teams and define incentives for artificial intelligence bias detection and mitigation. Executives and decision makers need help in understanding artificial intelligence bias issues and their possible impact on their clients, impacted communities, and their own companies. Such education needs to be complemented by appropriate methodologies, which need to not only be adopted but also enforced and facilitated. To achieve this, companies need to define the most suitable internal governance framework for their business models and deployment domains. Not only should artificial intelligence systems be fair and exercise caution in amplifying human biases, but they should also make sure that they are not a source of inequality amongst groups or communities. It follows that diversity and inclusion within societies is another dimension of artificial intelligence fairness that refers to the impact of the use of artificial intelligence in a specific societal context. Far from increasing inequality, technology ought to improve accessibility and also reduce the digital gap along various axes, such as gender, disabilities, geography, and ethnicity. Fairness has a global dimension too, and must be promoted equally between different regions of the world, but taking into account the specificities of each region. Another important dimension of artificial intelligence fairness has to do with how to define the appropriate and shared rules, to assure that the particular artificial intelligence that is deployed and used is fair. Artificial intelligence producers should play their part in defining and implementing internal principles, internal guidelines, methodologies, and governance frameworks to make sure that the AI they produce is fair, robust, explainable, accurate, and transparent. However, there is no reason why other institutions shouldn't help co-create artificial intelligence frameworks. We're talking about guidelines, best practices, standards, audits, certifications, regulations, and laws. After all, it requires a careful combination of these mechanisms, defined through a multi-stakeholder consultation, to frame the fairness of the artificial intelligence technology use and its impact on society correctly. The space of artificial intelligence fairness is therefore wide and complex. All artificial intelligence stakeholders should devote time and resources to playing their part in their relevant portion of this space. The main motivation is clear: making sure that technology respects and supports human values and prevents them from being put in danger. However, there are other motivations for artificial intelligence builders too. Indeed, addressing artificial intelligence fairness is both an economic and a social imperative. Companies that deploy artificial intelligence or other technologies but cannot be trusted to uphold the values explored here will have challenges in having their products adopted widely.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La 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 la
we're going to be talking about some of the Islamic laws hovering around marriage or marriage-related questions, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a woman, in fact, or to for the woman and wife her husband to have sexual intercourse before consummation of marriage and after nikah?
Of course, after the nikah is solemnized, it is permissible for a man and his wife to have any kind of pleasure and to have any kind of physical intimacy, and also it's permissible for them to drive any kind of pleasures, because they are halal to each other.
Yes.
They are husband and wife, just as a regular husband and wife can have physical intimacy and they can drive pleasures from each other. They also can, they are halal for each other, and therefore they can have intimacy, they can joke with each other, they can have physical contact, and they can see each other naked and so on and so forth, of course. And it is permissible for such a man and such a woman to drive all kinds of pleasures from each other, because they are halal and they remain halal for each other. So even if the marriage has not been consummated, mm-hmm. and even if the bride has not gone to her husband's home, they can have physical intimacy.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, is it also obligatory for the the couple, in fact, to give a kind of feast? We all know that when the marriage ceremony is held, when the formula is read or the marriage contract is read, there is usually a kind of feast going on, and people have a kind of ceremony to celebrate. So is it obligatory, is it necessary for the couple to give this feast, for example, the consummation of the marriage?
Yeah. Many people in the Indian subcontinent think that that giving feast is mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
It is obligatory, while it's not true. Okay.
Yes.
I think we need to correct ourselves. We need to improve our knowledge of what is haram and what is obligatory, what is recommended and what is makruh. Giving walima or feast is actually recommended for those people who can afford it. And those who are poor and cannot give a feast, it's not even recommended, okay? But for those who can afford it, yes, it is recommended to give a simple walima, not a very expensive feast, okay? Because the feast that is given, that is served, can be very expensive, very costly for the families, as we see nowadays. Some families and some young men and young women cannot marry because of the burden, because of exactly. The cost, because of the heavy cost,
yes,
and because of the marriage
high expenses.
The expenses. This is one of the hurdles, one of the problems, unfortunately. And the Islamic Sharia advises and recommends a simple feast, and that simple feast is recommended. Whether it is given before the consummation of marriage or after the consummation of marriage, it does not make any difference. The aim and the purpose of behind giving this walima is to make it public, to make it to let everyone know that you have married, that the boy and the girl have married each other.
Mm-hmm. I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Is it obligatory for the husband, in fact, to provide for his wife's food, expenses, clothing, and the like, while the wife is still in her parents' home, like when they are in the state of being fiancé, for example? All right, they are engaged, but in some cultures, of
yes.
course. Do the husbands have to provide for the expenses of his wife?
Well, depending on the agreement, okay. Generally speaking, since the wife is the consummation has not taken place,
yes,
the bride is still in her father's house.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the duty of the husband to provide his wife with food, clothing, and other expenses.
Right.
If it is indeed placed, if a condition is placed that after nikah, the husband will be responsible for the maintenance of the wife, even if the marriage has not been consummated, then of course the husband has to comply with the conditions and go ahead and of course maintain his wife and provide his wife with food, clothing, and other expenses with their normal and customary expenditures, okay? But if this condition is not placed, then based on the custom,
mm-hmm.
It is not the responsibility nor the duty of the husband to provide his wife with these things before the consummation of marriage.
Mm-hmm. I see. In today's life, where the expenses are going high and everything's on the rise, people have to work. I mean, both parties in a family have to work, you know, to make ends meet sometimes.
Yes.
It is not like the traditional type of life that people expect only the husband to be the breadwinner,
yes.
right? And sometimes the wife has to also work in today's life. If there is a woman who's working and she has her own salary. Can she spend her salary, in fact, without her husband's permission? And does she need to give it to her husband, or she can, you know, have it all to herself?
You're right. Some women work with the consent of their husbands.
Yes.
And they have their regular stipend, salary.
Yes.
And income, of course. The income that she receives is her own asset, and it is not that of her husband. So she has the right to use it wherever she likes to or wishes to spend. And the husband has no right whatsoever to ask her, his wife, to give a portion of her salary to him.
However small it is.
Yeah, however small it might be. So she cannot. He cannot expect her even to give her salary to him, so that that he can spend it for the daily expenses, mm-hmm. on the daily expenses. And of course, she has the right. The wife has the right to give it to her husband, to give it to her parents, to buy things, mm-hmm. She needs, and she has the absolute right to do any of these. So unfortunately, many men think that it is their right to spend out of their wife's pockets. That's not true. So it is the responsibility, the sole responsibility of the husband to provide his wife, even if she has her own daily, her own income and her own salary.
Yes.
She still can take and receive money from her husband, and she has the right to do this. Mm-hmm. Yes. She can save.
The financial providing this duty belongs to the husband.
Yes. Of course,
is still there.
She has her own salary. She can put it aside, save it for her rainy day, mm-hmm. and still demand and expect her husband to provide her with her daily essentials.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim, Mannan Kareem, Salam Alim, La ilaha illa hu, Ghaffar Jameel, Wahhab Latif, Tawwab Sami' Basir.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it's obviously the system is not working. A political system hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest poll shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th during an inauguration ceremony that wasn't attended by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The reason for that absence was made clear just hours after, when Biden signed over a dozen executive orders reversing policies adopted by the previous U.S. administration. The Biden administration says it will roll back Trump's policies that are harmful to Americans and to the rest of the world. The new president signed an order lifting the so-called Muslim ban. The U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement on Climate Change and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has also taken action on the COVID-19 pandemic and signed an executive order to rejoin the World Health Organization. Absent from the announced Biden 100-day program, however, is any proposed reversals of Israel policies implemented by the Trump administration that risk security concerns of a global scale, including moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel, U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel, U.S. support for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, and the assassination of foreign figures.
Anything you want to do in the United States as president or Congress or almost any part of government, you need Israeli permission. You know, Israel is the one that allows you to do things and puts a veto on anything they don't like. It's very unusual for the United States to do something that Israel doesn't like. And in this case, Israel doesn't want to reverse any of these policies.
In his confirmation session in the Senate, Biden's pick for Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stresses support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem. But he remained silent on the many concessions made to the Tel Aviv during the Trump administration, leading Israel to believe that the new administration's policies won't differ much from that of the former president. In the first volume of his presidential memoir, A Promised Land, Barack Obama writes about the pressure exerted from Israeli lobbies. He wrote that American politicians who criticized Israel policy too loudly risk being tagged as anti-Israel and possibly anti-Semitic, and were confronted with a well-funded opponent in the next election. He added that Israel's supporters in the U.S. use accusations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of the regime's policies against the Palestinians. The former U.S. president further hit out at the pro-Israeli lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, saying that the group moved to the right ideologically to mirror Netanyahu's administration and defended Israel even when its actions were contrary to U.S. policy. Obama also wrote that while congressional Republicans did not care about Palestinians' rights, their Democratic counterparts were, quote, worried about angering AIPAC and losing its support. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he opposes West Bank settlements construction in line with an international consensus that Israeli structures in the occupied Palestinian lands violate international law. He has further vowed to return to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump abandoned in May 2018. In such a political climate, as described in Obama's memoir, Biden will be fighting an uphill battle should he decide to overturn any of Trump's policies on Israel.
Frankly, I think that Biden is afraid of trying to reverse any of these. And why take a chance? Israel's happy with it, just leave it alone. That's the way he looks at it.
Only time will tell whether Biden, who faces numerous challenges both from the inside and abroad, would choose to risk his political career, which culminated in his presidency, by going against Israel's agenda.
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. In his first speech as the U.S. president, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas: The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened in the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government, national security apparatus, that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups, is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown. And there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. It depends on how long this lockdown will last. And we have now indications it will be, another extension and another extension and another extension, as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks. So we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy is the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU, that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie. But with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe.
Thank you. In October 2020, the Saudi authorities announced that they were working on the notorious kafala, or sponsorship system, described by critics as modern-day slavery. Under the kafala system, the legal status of migrant workers is controlled by their employers, leaving them prone to abuse and exploitation. Right now, almost one-third of the kingdom's 34 million people are composed of migrant workers, and almost half of that number work as drivers. It's hard to believe that these drivers of luxury cars are among the most vulnerable in Saudi Arabia, but that is the reality less reported. While Riyadh has promised to roll out the kafala reforms in March this year, these reforms don't apply to the 3.7 million domestic workers, as they're excluded from the kingdom's labor law.
I think they are a cosmetic exercise because the fundamental relationship doesn't change. The laborer is still tied to the sponsor. Only after 12 months of working there can they change jobs, and they have to do that through a long process through the Saudi authorities. So there's no real change. It looks very cosmetic.
This means all these workers will remain at the mercy of their employers, with the least possible, if any, legal protection. According to Al Iqtisadiya newspaper, drivers in the kingdom make up 55% of the domestic workers. Many of them complain that their employers delay, deduct, or don't pay their salaries for up to 6 months at a time. That's while they are forced to work for long hours and exposed to verbal and psychological abuse. Some of these drivers say they work 18 hours a day without a day off, a violation of the kingdom's domestic worker regulation. The fact is, these drivers, as part of domestic workers, are trapped. There's no real will from the authorities to protect them against abuse or exploitation. In the words of Rahna Begum of Human Rights Watch, "We have documented situations of domestic workers who have been confined to their employers' homes, their passports confiscated, forced to work excessive hours without rest or days off, and they happen to be subject to very specific forms of abuse, such as physical and sexual abuse."
Well, I think for domestic servants and laborers and drivers, this type of thing is common, and it's well documented by human rights organizations that this exploitation and abuse is going on. And sometimes we have high profile cases where that's happening. So I think there's no doubt that this is happening, and it's happening on a large scale within the Saudi Arabia, but also in other Gulf countries as well.
In November last year, Human Rights Watch interviewed a number of Indian and Pakistani drivers who work for private employers in Saudi Arabia. Their first-hand accounts draw a grim picture of the situation that they have to face every day. One of them says, "I have to work continuously from 7 a.m. until well after midnight." Another one says, "When they no longer need me to run their own errands, they send me to the madam's sister's house to run her errands." Another driver says, "It's like they own me, so they must use me every moment. Most days I do not have time to eat a proper lunch."
This is essentially a capitalist system of exploitation of human labor, where the laborers have no rights. They can't change without anybody's permission, and the Saudis can't build their economy without this. So it's a coerced system of labor, which relies on the fact that many people will come because their own countries are so so poor that this system at least gives them a little bit of a wage. Of course, if their own countries were much more economically developed, nobody would work under these conditions.
In just another case which shows the gravity of the situation for these foreign drivers, one Pakistani driver talks about his Saudi employer's behavior after an accident he had for which he was not responsible. He tells Human Rights Watch, "My employer has withheld my monthly salary of 1,200 Saudi riyals, that's $319 US, ever since as punishment. Because my employer is angry that I had an accident, my family back home is starving. I am starving. I don't have money to eat a proper meal."
I think we can't expect to see any improvement because basically the Saudi economy, like other Gulf economies, is built on this kind of exploitative labor, and therefore they are planning this new city and they have built their current infrastructure through this system. It's a very capitalist system which exploits migrant labor, treats them more or less as property to be abused and used, they can't build their economies without this labor, but their aim is to maximize the profits and the wealth available to the investors, who tend to be rich, wealthy Saudi families or businesses or corporations.
Due to the exploitative practices from their Saudi employers, these migrant workers, already in debt, may end up in a worse condition. Speaking from experience, these drivers say it's a waste of time to file a lawsuit against their employers. According to the driver who has had the accident, it is useful to go to the Makote Bala Amal labor office. The men there are ruder and even less cooperative than my own employer.
Well, the Saudi legal system is exploitative of laborers, migrant laborers in particular, and the whole economy, the infrastructure is built on this modern day type of exploitation of labor. And this it doesn't work in their favor. They are seen as second class citizens, and that's how they're treated.
Most of these drivers live in constant fear as they don't know what to do in a foreign country where migrant rights are not strict in practice. These drivers have to drive a long road before they reach a safe destination. For all these reform claims made by the Saudi authorities amount to real changes.
IRIB English Radio.